from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. More than 1,000 protesters swarmed the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office headquarters this week in response to the fatal shooting of a 13-year-old boy named Andy Lopez by a sheriff's deputy named Eric Gelhaus. Andy Lopez was carrying a toy gun that resembled an AK-47 assault rifle, and protesters are calling for justice and greater transparency from local police as the FBI and police launched investigations into the case. We want to talk about the shooting and the community's response, and we should say off the top here that we invited the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office, where the deputy in question is employed, but they declined to join us while the investigation is still pending. But joining us is Paul Gullickson, who is editorial director of the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat. He also writes the blog Inside Opinion at watchsonomacounty.com. And Paul Gullickson, welcome to Forum. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning.
And we'll also say good morning to Rafael Vasquez, who is a part-time faculty and outreach specialist at Santa Rosa Junior College. He advises the MECHA, the student group which helped organize the protest, and he joins us in his capacity as an individual, not as a representative of the junior college. We welcome you, Rafael Vasquez.
Thank you.
Also, want to welcome Eugene O'Donnell, professor of law and police studies at John Jay College in New York, former New York Police Department officer and prosecutor, and glad to have you back on Forum, Professor.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Yeah, good to have you all here. And it's a sad thing that we're talking about here, a very tragic thing, obviously. But let me begin, if I may, Paul Gullickson, with you, if we can just sort of outline the facts, because this is quite nuanced and we're still kind of getting some complicated and even conflicting information. This boy supposedly was told to put down his gun twice, but Gelhaus, the sheriff's deputy, couldn't recall whether he identified himself as a police officer. And the whole event and the episode itself took all of 10 seconds. I think I have those facts right, don't I?
That's correct. I think that's the most troubling aspect, is what happened in the course of that 10 seconds. That's a very short time span, which is what, according to the record, that's what happened when they were not responding to a shooting in the area. They was not responding to a call of concern that somebody walking around with an AK-47. They were routine patrol through the neighborhood. They came up behind the young man carrying the rifle, and according to the record, they one deputy got out, called to him to put down the weapon. The other was on the radio at the time calling it in. And 10 seconds later, they called back saying shots had been fired.
And they were behind their car doors, I understand. Were they?
They were behind their car doors, and the young man was walking away from home. From them at that time. The issue is, one, they did not recognize that this was not a real AK-47, and if you hold the two up, the weapons with a real AK-47, they are hard to distinguish, very difficult situation. And they did not, they said they did not see that it was a young boy. He is a large eighth grader, and they did not distinguish it was a young man carrying the rifle.
Was there not a witness who warned the young man to put his weapon away also?
That's come out, and we're trying to confirm that and it's not clear how long the interaction was. There was a report of somebody driving by who saw there was a police officer behind them, a unit behind them, and that they said to the young man, hey, you should put your rifle down. It's not clear whether he understood how long that exchange occurred or what. But that is a key question as to whether or not this young man really knew that there were sworn officers behind them. Because the issue is that there's question as to whether or not they really identified themselves prior to the shooting.
And Rafael Vasquez, a great deal of community outrage about this, demands for justice. What would be the form of justice, or what is being asked for?
I know that as an advisor for MECHA of SRJC, we've collaborated with different agencies and different organizations in the community, and there are four basic demands. One is that we need to create a community review board. We've been asking for that for about 13 years now, and all law enforcement agencies and many elected individuals have continuously said no, that is not necessary. Community members don't understand what police officers go through, but we believe that as community members, we will be able to, if we have a community review board, we will be able to make sure that all investigations are transparent. And that's exactly the second request that we have, or the second demand that we have. And the third demand is that we have continuous training of law enforcement agencies when dealing with diverse communities, not just the Latino community, but all communities, as we have about 60 different languages that are spoken in Sonoma County. We need to make sure that our officers don't receive 5 or 6 hours of training on diversity when, in fact, this is an ever-changing community.
I think you said four demands, though. Is there? I'm surprised that you're not talking about a prosecution of Eric Gelhaus here, are you?
Well, the reality is, if an investigation is done correctly and there is no form of any form of cover up, and the investigation is done correctly, then if it is found that this individual did not do his job correctly, then there naturally has to be a prosecution. And that's why we don't necessarily just put it out there on a regular basis. The last demand is that there be some funding from the police agencies given to nonprofit organizations in order for us, the community, to educate our youth and their families in their own language about their rights when dealing with the police. And we started this. Mecha of Santa Rosa Junior College started this 2 weeks ago. Interestingly, about 2.5 weeks ago, we did our first training where we had college students and high school students, and we had 35, maybe 40 of them. And we will continue to do this as many times as is necessary, but funding needs to be made available by these agencies.
Do you get the sense that a lot of these young people, I mean, these young Latinos, are really concerned that this could happen to them?
I think that the biggest fear that we are seeing in our community is truly exactly that, that if this officer, in fact, committed murder and is allowed to continue to wear that badge, that these kids, when I talk to 12-year-olds and when I talk to 13-year-olds and when I talk to 16-year-olds, they're saying, if this can happen to my friend Andy, then what is going to happen to me? And the other thing that I keep saying to people is anybody whose focus is just on Andy Lopez fails to understand the gravity of the situation where we have two different systems. We have the rich, we have the poor. And in this situation, we have officers. As a professor at Sonoma State University, when I taught there, I would offer extra credit to the students who would go 1 hour to the Roseland area, the poorest area in Santa Rosa, California, and then they would go another hour to Fountain Grove, the richest area in Santa Rosa, California, and I would ask the students to count how many dogs were walking around by themselves, how many cars from police officers would be in the neighborhood, all of this stuff, and the students would write a two-page essay, and they would come back, and they couldn't even put it into words, the different levels of experiences that the wealthy versus the poor have when you have police officers, in the community, but not interacting in the community, but harassing the community on a continuous basis.
This brings up, Eugene O'Donnell, the whole role of the police in situations like this, and whether it's fair or not, this particular deputy has been characterized as a bit of a cowboy, and he's written blogs where he's talked about Mean Gene and how important it is to act very quickly and so forth. It's unlikely, I suspect, that he will be in any way chastised?
Oh, I don't know about chastised. A civil suit is
inevitable. Yeah, I'm talking about through the courts, obviously. Yeah.
A civil suit is inevitable. There should be room for disciplinary action, including changing assignment. Criminal prosecution is going to be very hard in these kind of cases, and especially if you see the weapon that's involved here. And, the usual scenario is we know how this ends. So we are taking a look back at something that we haven't resolved and know how it ends. The police, when this is happening, don't always have that luxury. By the way, a lot of stuff that Raphael is saying is totally legitimate, but that's when you talk about a specific narrow set of circumstances, the police are going to have broad power to defend their lives. And a lot of police people have been in these situations. It's a well-recognized hazard to have fake-looking weapons. Obviously, assault rifles in this environment is even a worse situation. There's manufacturer laws about manufacturers doing this, city ordinances. I myself almost killed a person or shot a person with a toy gun as a rookie police officer. Fortunately, put the gun down. But this is a perennial problem. There have been initiatives to to reduce the appearance of these things, the orange indicators. Unfortunately, this narrow set of circumstances, the police are not required to be shot at first before they defend themselves. And any citizen, police or civilian, can make reasonable mistakes. And this, ultimately we'll see who makes that determination. But if you look at this weapon, looks real to me, I have to say.
Yeah, it certainly does. Those orange plastic muzzle caps may not even make a difference. And that brings up another question. I don't know if you have some thoughts on this, but a probably underreported number. The estimate is about 200 of these a year where police use force with imitation guns. And there's a lobby here, isn't there? I mean, wasn't there an attempt to have legislation to make these toy guns because they look so identical and so much like replicas not necessarily be as available as they are?
Absolutely correct. There is a lobby, and this child may have paid with his life for that lobby because there's been pushback about trying to have rational. I mean, bad enough we have insane gun laws to begin with, but now we have people defending the right to put into the hands of a 13-year-old this kind of weapon, a replica weapon. If I could just say, if I'm here for the law enforcement side, people shouldn't be taking sides here. This is a human tragedy for the people involved. And, people speculate about what this kid is up to. He's a 13-year-old kid, and people need to go no further. The responsibility, in my view, rests at the hands of the people who put this into commerce. And steps should be taken to make sure this never happens again.
But, Citizen C, a young kid wearing a hoodie, happens to be a brown kid, a white police officer. We've seen this sort of thing before.
Yeah, there's absolutely legitimate issues about that. There's no question about it. Once you strip away some very serious, sociological issues, you get into the narrow, split-second situation. There's not a whole lot to be said usually in those situations. And, people that point out the officer said he wasn't sure if he identified himself or not. I investigated police shootings, and I know that that rings true. I mean, sometimes the story that you hear, you worry because it's so pristine and perfect. The cops will tell you these things happen in a buzz. It seems to last forever, or there's frequently misperception and misrecollection in this kind of situation because you're only firing because you believe your life is imminently in danger. If you're firing for any other reason, you shouldn't be firing. So it's a quick and, in this case, tragic result.
Let me bring our listeners into this, and you can join this conversation. In fact, we welcome your calls. Toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking about the response to the shooting of a Santa Rosa teen, more than 1,000 protesters actually swarmed the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office headquarters this week in response to the fatal shooting of a 13-year-old boy, Andy Lopez, by a sheriff's deputy. And he was carrying a toy gun that resembled an AK-47 assault rifle. Paul Gullickson with us, editorial director of the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, and also writes the blog Inside Opinion at WatchSonomaCounty.com. Rafael Vasquez is a part-time faculty and outreach specialist at Santa Rosa Junior College and advises the MECHA, the student group which helped organize the protest. And Eugene O'Donnell's with us, professor of law and police studies at John Jay College in New York, a former NYPD police officer and prosecutor. Let me go right to your calls. We begin, Ryan, with you. Good morning.
Morning. I just wanted to ask why a non-lethal alternative wasn't used in this case. It just seems excessive, Michael, that 8 shots were fired at the boy regardless of what he was carrying.
You mean something like a taser, huh?
That's correct.
Yeah. Yes, Eugene O'Donnell?
Well, I know that the culture is trained to believe that, one or two or three shots is the magic number, and the reality is often in evaluating the perceptions of the cops, the more shots fired sometimes, the more you realize just how much fear they might have had, and then you can assess whether it's reasonable or not. But clearly, according to the account, he's given an opportunity to put the weapon down, doesn't comply, a taser would be an intermediate step that would not likely stop a fatal attack. So you're firing a firearm because you believe, again, imminently, you have an honest belief that imminently your life's going to be taken, and at that point you would be resorting to a firearm, not a taser. A taser is an intermediate step between physical force and deadly force where somebody's non-compliant, for example. But in this situation, with that kind of weapon, if you see it, it's quite optically alarming. It's not hard to understand why the police would fire if you credit the account that was given.
And that kind of weapon is rapid fire. I mean, we need to take that into account as well as some citizen misapprehensions about how you can, shoot somebody's hand and shoot a weapon out of it like they do in the movies. Let me go to more of your calls. William, you're on. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a defense attorney in Palo Alto, and one of the things that the Palo Alto police here have is they have cameras built into their uniforms. All the uniformed officers are able to record continuously traffic stops and just about anything else. It does three things. One, it helps prosecutions with a record of things that ordinarily would have to be done with testimony. Two, it builds in some accountability because the officers know that they are being reported. And three, when something bad happens like this, something terrible happens, there's a record after the fact of exactly what went down. I would invite comment on that, and I'll take it off the air.
Okay, we thank you for the call. Again, we'll go to you here, Eugene O'Donnell. It's a police question, really.
Well, you could add four, I suppose, which is the cops could become less anxious to act in situations they should act in, including protecting themselves. So that's always a possibility. When you camera police people up, they may realize, wait a minute, potential problem on Fifth Street. Let's never be on Fifth Street. You got to make sure that that's not discounted either. And also, of course, they have to have the right, like any other citizen, would have the right to, just because they wear a uniform, they are not required to be shot at first or be hit. They're entitled to defend their lives. But I mean, all things being equal, we find out with cameras that the police overwhelmingly do support them, because most of the time it vindicates them. I mean, it actually turns out that there's initial resistance followed by embrace, because most of the time the police are vindicated when cameras are actually what's shown there is released in the public realm.
Paul
Gullickson.
This is something we have talked about a great deal up here, and I think the evidence shows that in those areas, I believe in Cleveland and some other cities where they have started having cameras on uniforms or certainly mounted on the dashboards of units, it has shown two things. One, there are fewer complaints about police conduct. Two, that the actual people who are being pulled over and are suspects being apprehended behave better once they know they're being filmed. So there are clearly good benefits from having cameras involved in these things, and that's something that we've certainly brought up here. But I do want to bring up one other, just another point that I think that reasonable people can agree on two things. First, that walking down the street carrying an airsoft rifle that looks remarkably like an AK-47 shows incredibly poor judgment, and I don't think anybody doubts that. The second part is that he made a poor choice in not responding to the call of the deputy behind him, whether he was he apparently called to put down the weapon or stand down. We're not quite sure what his exact verbiage is. The question is that in and of itself enough evidence to be shot? Was that enough evidence to indicate that there was a clear concern about the deputy's life being threatened? Because at that point, apparently, rather than putting down the weapon, he turned and the barrel of the gun came up. He did not point it at the deputy. Nobody's saying he did that, but that the barrel came up. So there's a lot of questions as to what was the real threat, that, and did it warrant not only firing, but firing eight times?
Let me follow up that, Paul, with your response. It's Paul Gullickson, editorial director of Santa Rosa Press Democrat, to a listener named Alfred who writes, I've heard only one report in the new media relating the stories of the three witnesses and recording of the sheriff's radio report of the Lopez shooting. Both agree the deputy called in from his car, not standing outside his car, told Lopez once to put the gun down from the car, got out, and 10 seconds later shot the boy. The witnesses also related Lopez had his back to the officer and was slowly turning around with the pellet gun facing down when he was shot. Accurate narrative, Paul Gullickson?
Well, I'm not sure there was confusion there. There were two deputies. One was the trainee who was at the wheel, and he's the one who was radioing in, while the more senior one, Mr. Gelhaus, a 24-year veteran, was outside the vehicle and behind the door in a crouched position. And he was the one, my understanding is, that who called and said to put down the weapon.
Another listener, I want to just read a couple more website columns, writes, isn't it a tad early to have a forum discussion when we haven't even seen the patrol car video footage or heard the audio from the police encounter? There exists no evidence in the public domain except for the photograph of the toy itself. And Beth writes, the law clearly states that all of toy guns have to have orange paint or some bright colored paint on them to denote they are toys. Who removed the orange paint markings from the gun young Andy Lopez had? And had the toy gun had the orange markings, the young boy would be alive. And what if he had walked into the wrong house by mistake and the homeowner, seeing what looked like an AK-47, had shot him because he or she feared for their life? In our home, firearms are not toys. I want to get another caller from Santa Rosa on Brick. That's you. Hi.
Hi. I have a 13-year-old daughter who attends a different middle school, and she asked a very poignant question last night when we were discussing her want to go in the marches in Santa Rosa. She wondered why the officer insisted on using deadly force, her words, not mine, and why he fired 8 times, and why not just fire 1 time and take the boy down with a shot to the knees or some other non-vital place instead of taking him out, which was clearly the intent. Those are her words. I'd love to have the officer or the gentleman representing law enforcement explain to myself so I can explain it to her.
Well, before we go to Eugene O'Donnell, I'd like to go to Rafael Vasquez on that, because, Rafael Vasquez, I imagine you're hearing similar questions from a lot of these young people, are you not?
Yeah, and yesterday I was giving a lecture in another class here at Santa Rosa Junior College, and I've had that question asked of me many, many times. Among the many many degrees that I do have, I have a law enforcement associate degree from Santa Rosa Junior College, and I have several other degrees. And I remember having this exact conversation many, many years ago with a former professor at a local university. And when I asked that question when I was a college student, why is it that we don't shoot them in the leg and take them down just like they do in the movies, blah, blah, blah? And the answer was very clear, and that was because if they are there to testify against you, that civil lawsuit is going to mean millions and millions of dollars. But if they are not there to testify, it's a little bit cheaper to deal with the consequences of that. And I want to address the other issue very quickly, and that is, and this is important, in deciding to use deadly force. There are many, many cases in Santa Rosa and in other parts of California where officers have chosen not to use deadly force. But if you look at where Andy was killed, we have to ask ourselves, again, we have to go global, and we have to ask ourselves how many parks are in this area. And I invite everybody to go on Google and look up the location where this child was killed and look up how many parks are in that area. Andy had no place to play. The Boys and Girls Club that he belonged to would have to come in, basically pick him up and take him to their Boys and Club and Girls Club location in another part of the city, because there's no services here. And finally,
well, isn't this also near a park where kids would go and shoot paint guns?
There's some open fields in the area.
There's some open fields, but there is no park.
No, I mean, open fields. Okay. Yeah.
I understand. So then if the police really already has some knowledge of this, why did they suddenly assume that this individual was either committing a crime or about to commit a crime just when they should have known that? But finally, in Sonoma County, in Santa Rosa, there happened to be on the other side of town, and I keep mentioning this because this is important. In the wealthy side of town, recently, a woman went to her house, and her husband had changed the locks. She called for somebody to come and unlock the door. The man inside the house started shooting at them. And what did Santa Rosa Police Department do? Did they come in with the SWAT team, take him down, and kill him? No. They waited for this individual to go to bed, and then they went into the house, took him into custody, and he is alive today. One of the best things I saw during this march was a white individual carrying a sign that said, "My son survived playing with a toy gun in another part of Santa Rosa, which is an upper class and upper middle class area." It's about the perception that if you live in these poor areas, these low socioeconomic areas, you are eventually going to turn into a criminal, and we need to treat you as such. And that is something that very few people, especially those who don't live in the area, are pretending that doesn't happen. And I said it during the march. when I spoke, and that is the education that students get at L.C. Allen High School and Cook Middle School, which is the high school where Andy would have gone and the middle school where he was attending, is completely different than that at Maria Carrillo, where the middle and upper class students.
Rafael, forgive me. I know you're very concerned about these class differences, and I wish we had time, but I did want to get Professor O'Donnell's response to that caller from Santa Rosa who with a 13-year-old daughter. Eugene O'Donnell?
Sure. Think of yourself as a civilian confronted with an assault rifle and believing that your life is going to be taken or somebody else's life is going to be taken. If somebody's proposing there's a magic number of shots to fire, that would be a big mistake. Police have, depending on the agency, some police officers miss 80 or 90% of the shots. And even where they hit, what would the magic number that somebody would propose be? Would one shot disable somebody? Again, you are firing because you have an honest belief imminently your life is going to be taken. So somebody who's suggesting that two or three shots, how many times can people be shot and still present a lethal threat? There are recorded cases of dozens of times in some cases. So between the reality that cops miss when they fire and the reality that it does not always save your life, even when you hit somebody, it's a very, very hard thing to propose a magic number. And, of course, it's simply television land to suggest the police would be firing at somebody's limbs. If you're firing at somebody's limbs, you shouldn't be firing at all. You must not believe you're going to die. You're not target shooting. You're not shooting to make your point. You're not shooting to scare. You're shooting because by the time you fire, you believe you may be dead already. You're firing at the last possible imminent second of the interaction against somebody with an assault rifle. So it's awfully hard to propose to the police that they, you know, they should fire once and wait 5 seconds and look again. That's kind of an unrealistic suggestion.
Well, we'll have to leave it there because we're out of time, but we will continue to cover the story and follow what happens and hope that there will be justice of some kind and that the investigations either by the FBI or more likely by the police will actually result in shedding more light on this. I want to thank all our guests, Paul Gullickson from the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat and Rafael Vasquez from Santa Rosa Junior College and Eugene O'Donnell from John Jay College in New York. And thank you, our listeners. We would not be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Chad McClymans. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns, Keelan Cronin, Nick Zabrowski, Victor Vaya, Angela Johnston, Aaron Newport. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.